You're listening to Avasant on the Record, a podcast discussing key trends and insights into government-driven markets.
All right, well, we're back in action with another edition of Avasant on the Record. Today, we're talking about a very exciting topic, hacking for defense. No, it's not a cyber instruction manual, but rather an innovative university course that teaches students how to solve hard national security problems using lean startup methods. This is Josh Pavlik here, and I'm joined today by Chris Taylor, the professor at Georgetown, who is leading the inaugural H4D course. And I'm also with Jim Tinsley, a managing director here at Avasant. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
So I'd like to start off with a question that I think many people who are listening today are going to be asking. What is H4D? What is this all about?
At its core, Hacking for Defense is an educational endeavor. It teaches teams of 3 to 5 graduate students how to apply lean startup methodology to real national security problems. The educational effort is sponsored by MD5, the National Security Technology Accelerator over at the National Defense University. And that effort's led by Jay Harrison and Libby Prescott. And then it was pioneered first as a class out at Stanford. And that was led by Pete Newell, a retired Army colonel who ran the Rapid Equipping Force for the U.S. Army, Joe Felter, who's also a retired colonel from Special Forces, and the legendary entrepreneur Steve Blank. So that all started when a former Army special operator took Steve Blank's Lean Launchpad class. When he was done, he had a discussion with Steve that said, hey, this could be applied to national security. And from that conversation, this former special operator made an introduction between Pete Newell and Steve Blank. And from that conversation blossomed Hacking for Defense. It's all based on Steve Blank's Lean Launchpad class, the mission model canvas, and the value proposition canvas. For us at Georgetown, it made complete sense when we found out that they were going to syndicate Hacking for Defense to other universities to bring it to our campus. Why? Because I was already teaching a class called Business of National Security, which was a graduate level course on what happens when the private sector and the government come together to solve national security problems. It includes everything from the history of the private sector's involvement in national security, the economics involved, the regulatory and statutes involved, innovation, the use of force, we cover it all. So dovetailing Hacking for Defense on that sort of core course of understanding what happens when business and government come together for national security seemed like a great idea. I had a great discussion with Dave Maxwell, who's the associate director of the Security Studies program here at Georgetown. He's also a retired Special Forces officer. He got it right away. He said, okay, go do this. So we set off about trying to get the course up and running, and we taught our first class for this semester on January 11th. We also use a very unique teaching methodology. So students do their reading and watch their lectures outside the classroom, and we spend the classroom time with them presenting what they did for the week. That is, they had a hypothesis, they tested it, here are the results, here's what we're going to do next, here's what we learned. They are required to speak to at least 10 beneficiaries, customers, each week, or they can't even present. And there's a real reason for that, because validating a problem and a solution comes from true customer discovery. Understanding the problem as deeply as you possibly can, even when the people who have the problem may not have a perfect understanding of the problem, really matters when you're trying to come up with a solution. Because quite frankly, the solutions aren't as obvious for some as we want to believe. In fact, some of the problem statements end up being the wrong problem statements during this whole semester. And so I think on average, student teams and problem sponsors iterate the problem statements 7 times, 8 times because of the learning that takes place throughout the course. And that is an enormous skill for these students to learn as they go off into the marketplace. And it's actually very good for the problem sponsors because they're learning more about their own organizations and their own problems. And really, as we teach this class, I'm so very fortunate to have Matt Zace co-teaching with me. Matt is a lieutenant colonel in the Army and is also the deputy director of the Strategic Initiatives Group at the U.S. Army Cyber Command. So Matt and his organization were original problem sponsors for the original Hacking for Defense class. So he understands what it's like to be a problem sponsor. He also attended the Educator and Sponsors course at Stanford, and that's where we met. And so he's got a wealth of experience of how the system really should work. So having him as a co-instructor made perfect sense. And he happens to be a really nice guy as well.
So what are the types of problems that students at Georgetown are working on during this class? I know there's a number that are very important for national security, like augmented reality, like counter-drone technology. Can you talk a little bit more about the types of problems that students are actually going to be working on using the Lean Startup principles that you mentioned?
Sure. So problem sponsors within the U.S. government and national security give us these problem statements. The first one of the first ones we're working on is from the Joint Improvised Threat Defeat Organization, JIDO, and that's using augmented reality to help good guys tell bad guys in an unstructured crowd. That's one of the first problems. The second problem is a U.S. Special Operations Command problem, and that is a cross-domain solution problem, which says, how do I get unclass information into CIPRNet without having to go through an air gap process to get it in, so that it's more smoothly and far quicker into the CIPRNet process for dissemination to all special operators. We're also working on a social media and information warfare problem from the Asymmetric Warfare Group. And that's basically, how do we determine, classify bad actors using social media? And how can we intervene when necessary to help disrupt their plans and their message? Mm-hmm. So those are just a number of the problems that we're working on at Georgetown. And very exciting, as you know, because you were in the class. Smart students working on hard problems is a fantastic thing.
So these are clearly very hard challenges. What's going to help the students at Georgetown to be able to solve these challenges? You know, these are the types of things that I imagine there's been smart people working on these problems for a while. What do you think is going to help the students at Georgetown to be able to really successfully solve and address these really hard problems?
So I think a number of things. One of the first things is that we've created a team of teams. The student teams are at the center, and around them we have teams of made up of corporate partners, of mentors, of the problem sponsors themselves, and
investors. So Arsenal Venture Partners, who actually run the Army's venture fund, are present. And there's a reason for that. When you're using lean startup methodology to solve a national security problem, it stands to reason that at the end of the semester, there might be a there worth an investment. For instance, at the end of Stanford's first Hacking for Defense class, 5 of 8 teams received additional funding from their problem sponsor or from venture capitalists. In fact, one of those teams formed a company and just finished their A round of capital raise for $2.6 million. So it's a great indicator of the efficacy of the solution that these student teams had come up with.
And we have all of those people in the classroom all at the same time. So supporting their activity, as I always say, we want those teams to help them with their homework, but we don't want them to do their homework for them.
Right.
The second thing is to really impress upon them that just because they've been given a problem statement doesn't mean that that's really the problem. It is what the customer sees as the problem today, but through beneficiary discovery, customer discovery, hypothesis testing, and iteration, we ultimately may find that with some of these problems, it may not be what the customer said. And that's okay. As a matter of fact, that's a win. That's a double win for us. So their ability to remain in discovery mode, to question everything, to not just take yes or no for an answer, is huge. One, it
helps us get to right with the problem, and two, it helps make them far better problem solvers when they leave school and go into the marketplace.
Absolutely. I thought that was one of the lessons of the first class that really stuck with me, is the problem is not immutable. You know, it can change, and that's okay. I think that's a good lesson for everybody across the sector, that, you know, these problems, you know, don't have to be set in stone, and it's okay to fail. Oh, fail fast, but learn from your mistakes. Learn, you know, that the problem is not necessarily what you thought it was. And I think that's a very powerful lesson.
I think that we, if we could sort of reduce life to halftime speed, we would find out that many of the things that we think are problems are actually not the problems that are affecting the outcomes that we would like to achieve. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully these students are going to understand that, to question everything, to no matter who's telling them, a colonel, a general, who cares? At the end of the day, when they start to connect the dots through their discovery, they have to be able to stand up and say, this is the real problem, and this is, and we need to tell you about it.
So that's a good segue to Jim talking a little bit more about how Avison can support the program. We're going to be involved as corporate partners, and Jim and I will be mentors to the program and part of this broader ecosystem that Chris mentioned that's going to be helping the students' teams to solve the problems. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, your impressions from the class, and then also, you know, how you see Avison supporting the process?
Sure. So I think really supporting the team of teams concept, Avison can be effective in a couple of different ways. The first is as mentors to these teams, and not just mentors in terms of subject matter expertise or market data, which can be extremely helpful as they build the business cases and solution sets, but also helping them challenge their assumptions about what the core problem is or what the range of different solutions would be. I think because Avascent is involved in the defense industry and really a variety of players, from the largest prime contractors to very small subcontractors and even services suppliers and firms, we've seen the whole range of different ways to solve a problem. And so I think we can come to them and say, you may think this solution is a device. Well, the solution could be a concept of operations. The solution can be a series of different service offerings that are both contractor and government led. It can be a reimagination of how we conduct a process from a requirements generation perspective that says, like the air gap problem, perhaps the issue is not so much that we need to have devices that are cleared before they enter the CIPRNet, but why did we not have a cleared device to begin with on the UAS or whatever system it was that's supposed to plug in? So we should beg some fundamental questions about why we designed something a certain way to begin with. And I think the experience that Avison can bring from the industry perspective is that's not always as straightforward or as thoughtful as it might have been assumed to be by a student in a class.
So as I mentioned, we had our first class this past week, and class is going to be going on through the course of the semester, not just at Georgetown, but there's really been a growth of Hacking for Defense across the country. And that's one thing that's really stood out to me is, you know, the program started at Stanford, but now we have a class at Georgetown. There's a class in Pittsburgh, San Diego. Chris, can you talk a little bit about what's helped Hacking for Defense scale up so quickly and catch fire the way that it has? What do you think is really helping to fuel that growth for the concept?
I think that when people see the methodology that we use and the results that it gets, they almost immediately see how they can apply it to a problem that they're experiencing right now. And once they've done that, because it's everything else they've tried hasn't worked out, it really gets to the efficacy of this methodology. The other thing is that, as I say at Georgetown all the time, look, graduate students, you can write another paper, read another book, that's great. But if you want to roll up your sleeves and get and solve a problem, a real national security problem in a team, which, by the way, is what your professional life will look like when you leave here, then come try this. And, you know, it's not just about solving this particular problem. It's about giving them a methodology and a framework through which to push their experiences, the problems that they may face out in the marketplace when they join it. So I think that people see the benefit right away. So they become fascinated with learning as much as they can about that process.
So you find that the students have really latched on to this ability to take ownership and really solve the hard problem. That
they are lit up about this thing. It's very interesting, as you noticed in class, in their great joy at attacking these problems, mm-hmm. week one, and they thought that they were already on to a solution. And we had to pull them back saying, you have no idea if you're onto a solution because you haven't spoken to enough people yet. Mm-hmm. It always comes back to this discovery process. The more people they speak to, the more discovery that they do, the better off they are at either validating or invalidating a problem statement. So I think at the first Hacking for Defense class out in Stanford, each problem statement actually was iterated on average 7 to 8 times as discovery continued. That's brilliant. I mean, imagine if we could do that in the national security industry for all of the problems that we're trying to solve for our government clients. Amazing. So again, I think people see it right away, they feel it right away, they understand it. And it's really not that, I mean, it takes a lot of thought, but the methodology is fairly straightforward.
Yeah, and the methodology can be applied to a number of different situations. I know there's Hacking for Diplomacy that's starting out at Stanford, right? So this is something that really is a philosophy that can apply in many different ways.
So they're actually, from a branding perspective, changing this to more of a Hacking for X mm-hmm. perspective. So we had Hacking for Diplomacy. It's now going to be called Hacking for Policy, Diplomacy and Development, HPD squared. There's Hacking for Urban Resiliency. There's going to be Hacking for Space. So people who have sort of a core set of challenges that they're trying to solve, In general, our problem sponsors have more problems than they have to solve. They welcome a smart team of grad students to come in and work on this problem and help them. Take it off my plate. Tell me I don't have to worry about it anymore. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's hard to turn down support from hungry, smart students.
But if we could talk a little bit about those students, one of the things that impressed me most in the first class was the diversity of the students. International students, not just people that had been in the military, but different backgrounds and business and the rest. Can you talk a little bit about how the diversity of the students beyond an engineering program or just, you know, something that would be a more traditional feeder of defense and aerospace, how that makes a huge difference in the methodology?
So it's something that we forced from the beginning. We made students aware at all the information sessions that, well, first of all, we should understand all the problems in Hacking for Defense as of today are unclassified problems. Therefore, they are eligible for Open University Forum, which means students from anywhere in the world who are enrolled in the university can work on the problems. So say that up front. We actually told students that you may not come to us with 4 MBAs, 4 security studies program people, 4 computer science. You just can't do it. We want you to bring to the problem a diverse set of experience and lenses through which you can push the problem set, because everything in national security has a policy side to it, has some sort of perhaps a tech side to it, has a legal side to it, has a regulatory side to it. I mean, it just goes on and on. So why not create these teams from the beginning with that sort of talent on them? And I think, as you saw, we have computer scientists, data analysts, former military. We have some lawyers in the room. We have policy folks. We run the gamut of talent that's available to us at Georgetown.
So, Chris, you know, looking ahead to the, you know, the end of this course, but then also thinking about Hacking for Defense more broadly as a concept, how do we know ultimately whether this has been a success? Do you guys have any particular metrics or things that you're looking for where you say, yeah, this, we did this, so therefore we've accomplished success? Is it scaling up the program? Is it solving a number of problems? Is it return on investment for end users? How would you kind of define what success looks
like? So I think there are 3 major metrics that can either be present by themselves or collectively. One is, did we solve a problem? Right? Does the problem sponsor feel like we took something off their plate? So that's number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, first and foremost, this is an educational endeavor, right? Students are paying tuition. We're teaching them a methodology to apply to national security problems. They need to walk away understanding the work that they've done and understanding the methodology. Mm-hmm. Right? It's a must. The third thing is there a there at the end? So whether they receive additional dollars from the U.S. government to continue the work that they did during the semester, whether a venture capitalist in the room says, I really like what you've done and I think that there's something else to it, that is another signal that the work that the team has done, and then indeed the whole program has done, has resulted in something that continues to generate interest. Those are all good signs that what we're doing is producing something of value, whether it's to the problem sponsor or to an investor or all of them.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Just hearing the stories about how students have received funding and they're continuing to pursue their projects, it speaks to, you know, what we talked about earlier. I mean, this is, it's really more than a course. I mean, the students here are making a lasting impact. They're really changing things.
If you think about the fact that the course is based on the Lean Startup methodology, which was originally, is still used to go through the startup, to start a company in a smart fashion, it only makes sense that at the end of some of these problems, we're going to find something that's worth some sort of financial investment. Interestingly enough, this is housed at SSP, at the Security Studies Program. Mm-hmm. Stanford houses it in their engineering program. The reason is, one of the challenges was we didn't want it to be housed in a business school for fear that MBAs would be chasing money instead of chasing the problem.
Right.
Now, that's not a, I don't mean that as a broad indictment across business school education, because the MBAs that we have in the class are fantastic. But we really wanted to make sure that institutionally we were focusing on problem solving, not venture capital money raising.
Right. At the end of the day, it's still about the end user, the war fighter, the customer. Venture capital, that's a benefit, but you know, it all comes back to, you know, the end user at the end of the day.
Right.
One observation I'd also make is the way that H4D has been marketed to students, and its intent is to, I believe, inspire the next generation of national security leaders, which has been a real issue for the aerospace and defense industry, to attract people that look at national security issues and threats and say, that's something I want to be involved with. And they have a multitude of other startups and other commercial ventures that they could be pursuing. As you've seen, these students who self-select into solving national security problems, but coming from such a diverse set of backgrounds, do you see yourself as essentially helping to create this next generation of folks and approaching problems in a very different way than an industry that has had trouble attracting, for instance, millennials?
Absolutely. So I teach another course at Georgetown in SSP at the graduate level called The Business of National Security. So I'm already committed to trying to seed the next generation of national security talent in both industry and government, regardless of where they decide to go. When I was given the opportunity to syndicate the Hacking for Defense course to Georgetown, it was a no-brainer because, again, we're giving students who are already going to serve, generally speaking, in either government or the industry, a set of tools that will help them problem solve. It's just one thing stacked on another, so that in 10 years, 15 years, as these new problem solving methodologies and we have greater success, we will have a real impact in the industry.
So, you know, moving to, you know, the industry more broadly, one of the things that I've been thinking about is how the principles from Hacking for Defense can be applied to the defense industry or the defense sector beyond the classroom environment. And so I'm curious for your take, what are some lessons from this class or ways of doing things that, you know, you think specifically industry or, you know, people within the defense sector can take away in terms of how they do things?
I think that the industry has sort of this established cadence of how we respond to requests for proposal, mm-hmm. market surveys. So there's this general cadence that seems to be rather long. If we think that the average time to get a product or a service contracted and working for somebody is between 18 and 36 months in many cases, our adversaries are moving far faster than that. Our technological dominance is eroding far faster than that. So if I'm a publicly traded company and I'm an interested shareholder, I'm concerned about how fast the company I've invested in and bought stock from is doing. If I'm a private equity owner, I'm interested in how quickly the company that I own can move and how agile it is. Mm-hmm. If I'm a board of directors, I'm interested in how effective my CEO, COO, senior management team is in dealing with this. And then, of course, that flows down to leaders throughout organizations to say, do I have the talent I need and the methodologies and processes I need to respond to the government properly, to solve these problems? Our cadence is so embedded in what we do, and it's too slow. We all know it. Nobody wants to say it out loud because nobody wants to talk poorly of anyone. It's too slow. We solve problems too slowly. We just have to get better at it.
Yeah, and you know, the strategic planning process is, you know, another thing. I often see as something that's very much a static thing. It happens once a year, twice a year, and then it kind of goes away. One of the things I find interesting about Hacking for Defense and the mission model canvas is that strategy is a living document, right? It's something that's constantly updated. And it really is fitting for the world we live in, right? You know, the world we live in just doesn't stop, you know, after your once a year strategy review. And, you know, that's something that, you know, to me, I found very interesting is just the whole idea of how the mission model canvas works and the fact that, hey, strategy can be updated. This is something that's living. It's not static.
You're absolutely correct. And I would say that it's a leadership issue more than anything else in the industry. We as leaders have to get comfortable with the fact that change is ongoing. Everybody likes to say it. Everybody likes to read a book about it and they write a little article about it. But how many of us are looking into our organizations and saying, am I prepared for the change that's coming? And I think because it's really a cultural issue, right? At the end of the day, this is a cultural issue. If you find yourself in a company where people routinely go, we made it, that's a company that's I'm going to see their bones on the side of the road of company success in this industry. We have to continue to strengthen our marketplace so that solving problems is not in addition to our 9-to-5 jobs. It is our 9-to-5 job. We have too many power lunches. We have too many networking events. We have no problems are being solved at those events. I'm blaspheming horribly right now, but it's true. Those power lunches, those networking events, if we're not solving a problem from it, it's useless. Don't spend the money on that. If I come to people like Avasant and say, I have a real problem to work on, and you guys say, okay, let's go work on the problem, that's what we should be doing, not chatting about it all the time.
Yeah, I completely agree with Chris. I think the benefits that I see from the application of Hacking for Defense to the industry are, one, we have to be more clear about our assumptions when it comes to a capture, when it comes to our strategic plan, investment planning, anything else. I think where I saw Chris really pushing these teams in that first class was, do you really understand the problem? Have you really checked all your boxes on assumptions? Do you know why you thought that that was your problem to begin with? Have you done enough customer or beneficiary discovery to understand that those assumptions are accurate, or were you just told you should do this? And I think that gets to the leadership issue that Chris is pointing out, which is not just comfort with change, but comfort with questions. And especially questioning of the original problem statement that you gave is a critical aspect to what you're doing. The second is, there are many times when defense industry is not posing alternatives to the customer that may not be very expensive alternatives, or at least alternative methods of doing the thing that we're doing now that would solve most of the problems without a new system, because we are system oriented or we are services oriented as a business. And I think that can lead to more interesting business models or shaping activities that say, if I want money for a bomber or a new fighter or whatever else it is, I better find ways of making mission execution a lot cheaper in other areas. And so I think if the defense industry can be a partner in that with government to say, here are the hard problems that you have, here are creative solutions for those that will not cost a lot of money, it could be a change in how you operate, a change in how you buy, and maybe not buying something anymore, but buying something completely different. I think they could be part of that process rather than just chasing, as Chris talked about, the latest RFI, RFP, AOA, all these other acronyms that we use in our acquisition process that essentially disconnect a team that is essentially a capture team win from a thought leadership team that would say, let's solve the problem, not just win.
Amen. Hallelujah.
I listened to the first class.
Yeah. Good. At least you did. I would also, I say that I don't want to let the government off the hook. I don't want to beat them up, but I don't want to let them off the hook. Here's why. No matter what we try to do, we still have the federal acquisition regulations. And I've said before, in 1787, our smart founding fathers got together for a constitutional convention to figure out a way to improve on the Articles of Confederation. I think that the Federal Acquisition Regulatory Council, which is made up of the Office of Federal Procurement Policy, the Secretary of Defense, GSA, and NASA, should convene a FAR convention of 2017, whose delegates will come from the Avicents of the world, industry companies, Congress, federal agencies, the legal community, and of course, the broader business community outside of business, to say, can we do this better than we're doing it right now so that we can solve more national security problems, which ultimately gets us more distance from any near peer competitors that we may have across the spectrum of national security? I would love to see a FAR convention. I really, really would love to see a FAR convention.
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't let industry off the hook as much, mainly because there are ways that you can work with the FAR to have rapid acquisition, and there certainly have been rapid acquisition cells that I know you've been involved with at different points in your career. And certainly the teams that are working with beneficiaries as these problems have found a way to not get around the FAR, but essentially work within the FAR in a more dynamic way to say, before we get to the acquisition, what are we actually buying and what problem can we solve and what would be the best structure for that acquisition to get there? I think assuming that the FAR is the first step in the process is probably the worst decision that we make as both industry and government trying to push for something that's, you know, beholden to that rather than thinking about the problem more generally before pushing it into acquisition. And I think that's the advice you kept providing your teams is, I'm not just looking for acquisition solutions, I'm looking for problem solutions, and then we can figure out where we go from there.
Yeah, and so just to be clear, from the FAR perspective, I'm basically saying that I understand all the waiver capability within the FAR, but the fact that there's waiver capability sort of speaks to the fact that perhaps there's room for improvement in all of this. I would also say that I agree, the industry really needs to bring new solutions, new ways of thinking in order for the government to be less risk averse about some of the solutions that they may encounter. Man, we can do so much good. We can, partnering with the government, this ecosystem could be amazing if we just sort of took a step back and said there's a better way to do things.
Well, great discussion for today. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Chris.
My pleasure.
Thank you. That's a wrap for Avicen on the Record.
You've been listening to Avicen on the Record. To learn more about Avicen, go to avicen.com or follow us on Twitter @Avicen.